Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Drexel.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we have a theme for this week's pod.
I'm excited about this episode.
Yes. So we've been focusing a lot on foreign policy. We spent the past two episodes really talking about foreign policy and our larger geopolitical relationships with Syria, Russia, that sort of thing. And so today we are going to be focusing on what is going on domestically.
Yeah, what the fuck is going on with our shit?
Well, exactly, because it's fucked up. Really fucked up. So we're going to talk about, there were a couple stories about young black men and young black women being harassed for being in public for no other reason. We're going to be talking about what the fuck is going on with our educational system. You know that my arch nemesis that I've set up in my head is Betsy DeVos, and I hate her. But there have been teacher strikes in the past couple of weeks, and there's a lot going on with state level races as they relate to education policies. It's very interesting. And then we're also going to be talking about Paul fucking Ryan.
As one does.
I mean, just as one does. So Paul fucking Ryan, and then also Trump pardoning someone super random.
Yeah, that one came out of a little left field. We'll definitely have to get to that.
Yes. So, but first, before we get started, Drexel, how was your weekend? Well, we're recording on a Sunday night.
We are.
So weekend's not even over yet.
So for those who were hoping that we would be talking about the Jim Comey interview tonight, we will definitely have to get to that next week. Or you can just follow us on Twitter, because I'm sure we have said some things.
Said some shit.
I listened to your really great interview.
Yeah.
Or maybe I listened to it on Friday.
Yeah.
Or maybe I listened to it Thursday. I can't remember. But that's how my days run into each other. I did nothing. I didn't have anything to do this weekend.
That's so nice.
I laid on the couch and watched TV and tried to find Scooby-Doo on Amazon Prime, but it wasn't there. That was...
Goddamn.
Let me tell you what. I'm a huge Scooby-Doo fan, and I have been trying so hard to find ways to watch the old Scooby-Doo, because I don't really like the new Scooby-Doo.
Right, I don't either.
But it's not nostalgic enough. It's not nostalgic. I really love it. So yeah. I've been trying to... That's been my goal, other than, you know, wedding stuff, of course. What about you?
Well, so last week I had this big interview with Cecile Richards.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I've mentioned it once or twice or 3,000 times. And so I was working on that. I've been reading. I've been prepping for, you know, I'm going to the East Coast tomorrow to go on Good Morning Connecticut. And I've been prepping and I'm doing all this stuff. And this weekend, actually, Friday night was a good friend of mine's birthday. And so we all went out to this. It was very low key. It was just four of us. We went out to dinner, and then we went out to this swanky new bar in West Hollywood called Employees Only. And because I live my life on level 10 dangerously, it's like not that late. It's like 11:30. I'm at a swanky West Hollywood bar in a booth with my husband and two of our very dear friends. And I fell the fuck asleep. I didn't pass out. Not pass out drunk. I fell asleep.
The idea that you went out is a feat in itself.
Exactly.
I joke with my friends all the time, because I'm like, man, I remember when we could just stay out until 2 and then like, because the bars on the East Coast close at 2.
Right.
And then go to Cookout, because this is Raleigh. So if you're from the South in that area, you know what Cookout is. And go to Cookout at 3.
Right.
Or Waffle House.
Right.
And still be awake enough.
I know. 11:30.
To deal with that. Now.
Yeah.
Now I have to take a nap and we fall asleep in booths. The problem. We sit in booths. Right. We're too bougie. We're like, you know what? I cannot sit at the bar. Like, I walk into the Federal here in North Hollywood. Yeah. I'm like, do you have a booth?
I gotta take a quick...
Not only do you have a booth, do you have the booth with the curtains?
The curtains.
Because I really don't want to see people.
Right.
I did not come out of my apartment to see people.
Exactly. Close that fucking...
Close the curtain.
Close the curtain.
I can't drink in public or I'll fall asleep. That's what you needed. You needed the curtain.
Curtain there.
All right, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback from, you know, that interview that you did
that
last week.
Small interview that I haven't talked about at all.
It was so tiny.
It was so tiny. So obviously, I had the biggest interview. I think for me, it feels like to date. Like, this was a huge watershed moment for me. It was with Cecile Richards. She was president of Planned Parenthood and wrote a new book called Make Trouble. It was fantastic. And we got really, really great feedback to that interview, which was so touching to me on so many levels. I mean, I kept the episode very short. It was all about that one interview. And I had not just people, not just listeners, but I had like friends and family call me to tell me how much they enjoyed it. I think partly because I made it so clear that this was so important to me that everyone was like, oh, okay, if I want to get in good with Devin, I'm going to call her and tell her how wonderful this was. But it worked. But one of our Hellions, Katie, in the Facebook group said, Devin, I've listened to basically every interview Cecile Richards, is doing during this book tour, and this was one of the best. You asked really insightful and interesting questions and not the same old, same old. I loved it. I'm not even kidding that I'm sitting here in public with legit tears in my eyes, and I'm okay with it because Jen Palmieri says it's okay to cry. And that is literally the best thing that I've ever read on the internet ever. I printed that out and put it on my mirror.
Nice. It was just a really great, I mean, I think it threw her off with some of the questions because she was like, oh, nobody ever asked me that.
Yeah, right.
Because I think you took quotes out of the book that nobody ever focuses on because everybody wants the more salacious parts of books.
Right.
And I just thought it was really great. Of course, the Harry Potter stuff. Was really funny to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm 100% positive that Cecile Richards is a Slytherin just like us, as much as she doesn't want to admit it. She tried so hard not to be a Slytherin that it sounded
clearly
like a Slytherin.
Like, not Slytherin, not Slytherin.
Right.
Not Slytherin.
Like my daughter's going to be so mad if I get this wrong.
So.
Which was very Harry Potter of her.
Right.
Because she did not want to be in Slytherin so bad.
Right.
One of my favorite quotes that I am taking into 2016 from the interview was when she said, if you're not doing something hard, you're probably not setting your sights high enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's my mantra for 2018.
Absolutely.
And I think it should be everybody's mantra because I think that is what we're going into with this midterm election.
Yeah.
And those that are running for office out there, because yes, running for office is very difficult because you, financially and mentally and physically.
Stressful as hell.
And so if it's not hard, then
you're not really doing it. Yeah, exactly. If you're not falling out, if you're not falling asleep at bars 11 o'clock at night,
then
what are you even doing with your life?
What are you doing?
All right, Drexel, let's jump right into our news block. We are going to be talking about what the fuck is going on in America right now.
Yeah, block two is aptly titled America.
America.
We don't talk about race a lot in general. I don't talk about race a lot in my personal life. So when I do talk about it, I try to do my best to understand where a lot of people are coming from on both sides, because I grew up in a military family where I never in my life at this point, in my 30s, have I experienced racism in the way that I know a lot of other people have. So I've been very lucky in that sense that maybe it's not luck at all because I've been shielded from it.
Right.
So I haven't got the full force of what that feels like to understand and be able to articulate it a little better. So every time I have race conversations with people, I do feel a little bit left out. Like it seems like I'm like an imposter to race conversations.
Interesting.
Because I always tell people I cannot talk about something I have not fully experienced yet. It's almost like when men talk about women's issues, we have not fully experienced that and what that means. So all we can do is sit back and listen and respond in a way that is supportive and figure out ways to combat that in tandem with what somebody's doing.
Well, that's really interesting that you say that, though, because I feel like that even if you don't feel like that there's been that that sort of overt racism in your life. I mean, just by virtue of being a Black man in America, I feel like the way our country interacts with you is inherently different.
It can be.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's been my experience.
Interesting.
I guess the way that I carry myself in public is very confident enough to where people just assume that I know what I'm talking about sometimes, or they just don't mess with that at all.
Right.
I don't know if there are things that have gone on around me, I either subconsciously tune them out, or not. That's not to say that I do not see other that stories like ones that we're about to talk about don't bother me.
Right.
Because I know that those are situations that happen to my friends. I know that in the workplace, if you watch Scandal, there was the episode, not this week, but the week prior, they did a montage of Olivia talking to her dad about having to work twice as hard. That part I know.
Right.
That we have to work twice as hard. Well, I went to private school in Savannah when I was in elementary school. And I know that I had to work twice as hard as some of the other kids. That part I know.
Right.
But I was never treated differently because of my skin color.
Hmm.
As far as I know. Now, my parents might have seen that. But that was not my experience as a kid. But I did know subconsciously that I wanted to be the smartest kid in the class and I needed to work just as hard as everybody else to make that happen.
Right.
So when we talk about this Starbucks situation, first of all, I love me some Starbucks.
Yeah, me too.
This hurts. This hits me hard because I'm a Starbucks Gold member and I take pride in the amount of stars that I get on Double Star Day.
So if you have not been
following along in Philadelphia, and this is a story that I had to, like, when I read the headline, I was like, where in America could this have gone down?
Right.
So, excuse me. Two Black men were arrested waiting at a Starbucks in Philadelphia for a friend. They asked to use the bathroom code and was told it was only for paying customers. Now, that's not the first time I've heard something like that in any establishment.
Right.
And I assume that every establishment is... their policies are different because some are franchises, some are not, whatever. But the story gets a little more...
it goes off the rails.
Interesting when witnesses start to say, well, I didn't buy anything and I asked for the bathroom key and I was given the bathroom code.
Right.
The manager did not ask them to leave, instead called the police who arrested the two young men. This is a part of the story that
falls apart a little bit.
Yeah.
You're just like, what is going on?
So an eyewitness described the event. The men told the officer that they were waiting for a friend to arrive and offered to call that friend to prove that they had legitimate business at the restaurant. At that point, she said several officers began to move tables and chairs around the two men to take them into custody. I don't know why that was necessary. A friend for whom the men was waiting for then arrived and attempted to intervene, but police told him that the men were not paying customers and thus were trespassing. The two men stayed calm, did not raise their voices. Everyone in the Starbucks, however, was appalled. Another woman had entered the Starbucks minutes before the men, were arrested and was given the bathroom code, like I said, without having to buy anything, and that another person in the restaurant at the time of the incident announced that she had been sitting at the Starbucks for the past couple of hours without buying anything, probably doing work,
right,
like we do when we need to go somewhere.
Right, you buy a coffee and then you sit there for 3 hours.
So Starbucks has obviously come out with this statement that they're looking into the incident like any other
company would.
I'm trying to understand, and the story is not quite coming together a couple of days later, where the manager's decision making came into that, or the associates,
whoever called.
It says the manager, but somebody had to call, and so that's a little weird to me.
There's also an investigation in the police department about, you know, these officers were called and then ended up arresting these two men, held them in custody for more than 8 hours. And there still seems to be no understanding of why the two men were arrested beyond trespassing, which is on thin legs to start with.
Philadelphia PD mm-hmm. is... obviously a very large police department. So I'm very surprised that they took the approach that they did, considering how many African-Americans live in Philadelphia. So this idea that they went in, they were moving tables and chairs, like, did they ever talk to the manager?
Right.
What was that conversation like? Because if they never had that conversation, other than the phone call, but then they had to have talked to somebody.
Right, when they got there.
When they got there to point out who the quote-unquote perpetrators were.
Right. So it's a very confusing story. But again, this comes back to my privilege, where I have never experienced anything like this firsthand. And so for me, I don't understand the thesis of this story, but I think that's the point. I think that's the problem. And I saw a tweet in which I cannot for the life of me remember who it was, but it said, yes, of course, it says in every, you know, corporate manual, like, don't be racist, like, train people. But it's not about training people. It's about untraining them. It's about untraining them to be racist. It's not about training them to do anything.
Yeah, I saw something where a police department, I don't know which one it was, is starting to add Black history to their training.
Right.
Great. But Black, like we said last week when we talked about identity.
Yeah.
When we talked about, like, really condensing it down, if you talk about Black history, you got to talk about Hispanic history, because Black, obviously right now, Black men are targeted a little bit more, but that will shift
right. When
police officers feel like they can't go after Black. They now have to go after somebody. They now feel like they have to go after somebody else. And that will just further on move down the line of somebody of color,
which is why I liked the idea. Again, if anyone knows who tweeted this, please let me know. I searched for it, but basically it's not about training or adding this sort of information like, you know, Black history, but it's about untraining these systematic ideas that we hold.
Yeah, I think that's difficult. It's hard because it starts at the home.
Right.
You can't expect people by the time they get by the time they get 18
right.
to unlearn something that they've already learned.
Right.
And I think that is going to be the challenge for parents as they start to bring children into the world, and parents who foster children, is to say, this is the way that we need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way that people should be treated. It's almost like the crazy thing about the Trump world of Republicans is that sometimes the most racist people are the Christians out there who claim to be morally superior.
Right.
You're like,
I don't think you know what that was.
Shit.
You racist piece of shit. Yeah. You know, this story, again, is not an uncommon one. And it's not even the only one that's in the news right now.
Right.
There's also a story about a 14-year-old boy who in Rochester Hills, which is where I'm from. My grandmother lived in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Missed his bus, tried to walk to school, and got lost. So he knocked on a door in this neighborhood to ask for directions. And the couple inside thought he was trying to break in. Why you would knock before you try to break in, don't know. And so a 53-year-old retired firefighter ran at him and shot at him with a shotgun. Because this kid stopped and knocked and asked for directions.
What triggers somebody's mind to think that a kid...
Right.
I mean, and if you saw him, if you've read the article, you've seen this kid. He does not look, he looks 14.
Yeah.
He's very thin. He does not look like he can overpower anybody or is interested in doing anything. The fact that he went into somebody's, the fact that he felt he needed to go to somebody's house to ask for directions means that he is not a privileged kid enough to have a phone to give himself directions.
Right.
That he's going, that he was taught to ask for directions.
Right.
If you cannot figure out where to go.
Yep.
And of course, I'm sure he was in a neighborhood that he felt like he could ask those questions.
Right.
And so, you know, he was very lucky to have not gotten hurt.
Right.
But again, a thing that this guy at 53 is not going to unlearn.
Right.
This is not something this idea that he was arrested and charged with assault with the intent to murder.
Which, like, he should be. He shot at a kid with a shotgun.
Which we know that I don't think that charge will stick.
No.
Because I don't think the intent to murder, I think the self-defense, he'll claim self-defense and that will be the end of that.
Right.
The felony charge of possessing a firearm, that'll stick.
Oh, sure.
Because, like, you don't get that unless that's really something that you're...
Right. Well, but, you know, it's interesting because you said, like, he'll claim self-defense and that'll be the end of that.
That'll be the end of that charge.
Right. But the fact that we just assume that, you know, that we've seen this over and over.
I don't mean that because we've seen it. I mean that... Anybody,
right,
from a legal standpoint, right. Assault with intent to murder
is
hard to prove.
Yeah.
If you felt threatened,
right,
and
right.
It sounds like from what the wife said to what the husband said, that they felt threatened at that moment.
Right.
I don't think that he went out of his way to. Oh, there's a little black boy walking down the street. That's intent to murder. You open your door, see a black boy walking down the street. That's when you.
Right.
Intend to murder that
so
person.
The intent to murder part is the part you're saying won't stick.
Is what I'm thinking won't stick.
Right. So I guess it's just frustrating because there's one more story too about Simone Sanders, who's actually a very well-known political organizer and activist. She's black. Simone Sanders is a very well-known political
MSNBC contributor.
Yeah, very, CNN. Very recognizable, right? She was Bernie Sanders' press secretary during his campaign, and she was detained at LaGuardia Airport yesterday. She tweeted, quote, "I was violently arrested at the security screening line at LaGuardia Airport. I was taken off-site and issued a summons for disorderly conduct. My attorney and I look forward to the opportunity to highlight this injustice and righting what we believe to be a profound wrong." And... again, there was no other reason for her to be arrested. I mean, disorderly conduct is a very broad catch-all term, right? Could have been anything. But, you know, this is not the first time that she's had issues either. Last May, American Airlines called the police when she tried to check her bag in at the airport. And it's this pattern of I guess... what I'm feeling from this, and my feelings are worth exactly dog shit, but what I'm feeling from all this is that it's just this assumption of guilt that these stories start with. And that, to me, was the unifying thread through these three stories in particular. It's you look at someone and you make your assumptions. And in these cases, when it comes to, you know, people of color, the assumption is they are doing something wrong.
Absolutely. I haven't flown out of LaGuardia in a long time. I flew out of JFK a lot.
Yeah.
LAX, of course, Burbank Airport. I can tell you that in my experience, almost, I want to say 60 to 70% of TSA agents are black to begin with. So I'd be very interested to know what TSA agent she came in contact with at LaGuardia.
Yeah.
Because LaGuardia is New York. So it's either they're either black or they're Hispanic. There's not too many white TSA agents coming out of New York in general. So I'd be interested to know that piece of it because I don't know that. I think it goes back to the intent to murder piece of it, which is from TSA standpoint, they have the authority to do whatever they want.
Right.
They've been given that authority to do that.
Right.
Do we feel like they need more sensitivity training to that? I don't know because they'll claim in the name of national security.
Well, yeah, this government in general gets away with a lot under the name of national security. So, but it just, I guess for me, looking at these three stories and having the conversation about, again, we're kind of decontextualizing this entire conversation a little bit because we're just reporting these three stories as independent news items. But they're, news items are never just independent news items because this is really playing along this larger backdrop of the Trump presidency, of Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions III and his backwards ass approach to civil liberties, the Department of Justice. I mean, we're looking at this on the backdrop of, you know, sending the Coast Guard to be support roles, which is something that's been done before. But, you know, we're really having this discussion about immigration. We're having this discussion about the people of color in this country. And I think that stage, and then you put these three stories in particular, which are three out of hundreds and hundreds that happen all the time around the country every day. And that, I think, is the conversation that we don't want to have.
Right. We have to be, I'm hesitant to say, be very careful about some of these stories because this, yes, in the area of Trump, in the area of this administration, everything is heightened.
Heightened. That's, I guess, what I was getting at.
However, like you said, this is stuff that was happening under the Obama administration.
Yeah.
When we talk about Syria, for example.
Yeah.
This is not something that did not happen under this. This idea of a executive branch unilateral strike,
yeah,
is something that happened under the Obama administration. Right. So we, when we have conversations outside of this, outside of listening to podcasts, outside of gather that information, and then do a little bit more research to find out. Okay, yeah. Before I have another conversation, let me find out if my side has done the same thing.
Sure.
And how would I feel about that if that happened? We have to be able to say, yes, where the race problems in America are not due to just Donald Trump.
Oh, hell no.
They were there under President Obama. They were there because of President Obama.
Right.
They grew in the 8 years that President Obama was there because President Obama was like, you know what? I'm going to do a program called My Brother's Keeper that's going to specifically focus on young black men of color coming up, blah, 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 blah,
right,
and doing that. To a white person outside, I don't know because I'm not white, I'm going to assume
right,
that somebody looking at that saying, well, why don't we have a program like that? Yeah. I can understand that piece of it, but, you know, like I said, this is not a Republican problem.
No.
This is not a Democrat problem. So I don't want people out there thinking that this Starbucks issue is because of something that Donald Trump has.
Oh, absolutely not. But that's kind of the point. It's so much more systemic than that.
Right.
It goes so much deeper than that. But it's just when you look at it on this stage that we're living in right now, that it creates a sharp relief of what is going on and what are the conversations we're just not having.
Right. And we're going to talk about in gratitude check. Well, we'll talk about something in gratitude check a little bit later, but yeah, black people in America definitely have it. We have it a little bit more difficult. And so that is not something that people should forget about, but more conversations like this, keeping people, you know, the kids from Stoneman Douglas have done a really great job of highlighting their privilege as the spokespeople for Stoneman Douglas and saying, well, now that we're doing this,
let's talk about this
because you media are not covering
this part of it.
This part of it, and not asking the black and brown kids to come on TV as well.
Right.
Actually, I think there's only one, but that they've asked, and he's Hispanic.
Right.
So yeah, you got to get more black folks out there.
Right. Right. All right. We are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about education. All right, Drexel, so continuing with our theme of America, there have been some teacher strikes in the last couple of weeks.
I've got some teacher friends in Oklahoma that have been to the Capitol.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Sure. Teachers are going on strike all over the country as each statewide strike happens. We saw one in West Virginia not too long ago, and of course, Oklahoma last week.
And then Kentucky and Arizona.
News of teachers in state, they're organizing on their own, whether teachers prefer to call themselves walkouts, work stoppages, or strikes. All of these states have one thing in common. Yes, these states all went to Donald Trump in the presidential election.
Which, I mean, that is something that
put a pin in that
because that is definitely true.
Yeah. But more importantly, there are also states with work to write laws and have cut public services. So for those that don't know what work to write laws are, they're basically union diluters.
Right.
And so these teachers' unions are not as strong in those states to have the conversation, to bring legislators to the table, to say, hey, we want more pay, and that's exactly what these teachers want.
Oh, I think West Virginia just straight out outlaws collective bargaining, which is union organizing.
And if you have been following everything Scott Walker's been doing, then yes, that is a, I mean, that's really a state where that right to work was really highlighted, other than Florida, I think, is a right to work,
right,
under Rick Scott and
yeah,
a few others. The chronic underfunding of education, sustained tax cuts, and right to work laws have created this environment, bringing the fight for education and labor rights to a boiling point in all of these states.
Right. So what I was found so striking about these walkouts and this striking is that the teachers are not just demanding more pay. They are. They want raises, because I highlighted it. Oklahoma and West Virginia teachers are some of the lowest paid teachers in the country, which teachers already don't make very much money. So that should tell you something. But they're not just demanding more money for them. They're demanding raises for school support staff. They are demanding general education funding raises. You know, they are asking for... they're asking for more textbooks and you know,
not just more textbooks. They're asking for new textbooks.
Right.
That's what they need.
Right. So they're not just talking. They're not just asking for raises. This is not a bunch of people going to their boss and saying, hey, we're really great, we deserve more money. That's not what this is. This is a concerted effort to shape education funding in a way that supports the students in that state.
I never have understood why Republicans have such a hatred for funding the education of children in this country.
Well, it's really funny because one of my favorite things Will Wheaton said to me at an event not too long ago was they don't want people educated so that they turn
Republican.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, yes, that makes sense on the surface, but a lot of those, every parent, regardless of you're Republican or Democrat, wants their child to be educated. Wants to say
on an individual level, you want that.
You want that. You want your kid to go to college. You want your kid to experience things out there, probably within the confines of their viewpoint.
Right. But you want your kid to be educated.
You want your kid to be educated.
It's a very interesting collective versus individual thinking structure that goes on, because collectively they want to cut funding to education, but individually they want the best education possible.
Right. So when Republicans talk about, especially Betsy DeVos, talks about...
My arch nemesis.
Your arch nemesis DeVos talks about charter schools. I don't know that a lot of Oklahoma families are trying to send their... Because it's so interesting to me, because teachers are also parents.
Right.
So at what point... So you're only hurting the children at the... What are teachers at public schools going to send their kid to a charter school?
Right, right.
Not only are teachers in these states who are parents trying to fund their personal child's education, but they're also trying to take... They're using their own money to buy supplies for students who don't have money.
Right.
And to try to teach them outside of that. I would like to see, if we need to get away from the textbooks, I'd like to see us move a little bit more we're in the technology age.
Right.
If kids need a better way to learn that, do we need to now? I know a lot of colleges, not a lot, but a few colleges, their textbooks are all online now.
Digital. Mm-hmm.
Do we need digital textbooks now? Does the state need to buy one-time iPads for kids?
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. We've got bigger fucking issues than that right now. These states, Oklahoma, some rural areas in Oklahoma have cut to 4-day school weeks. They've cut classes. They're rationing paper. This isn't even about how can we maximize the education these kids are getting. In a lot of these states, it's about getting kids educated full stop. Basics. And so what I don't understand is how someone can read that. And again, maybe this is the, like, I'm a mom in me coming out, but I cannot read that some child in Oklahoma only goes to school 4 days a week and not take that as a personal offense to me as a parent. Like, fuck that. We need to get everyone to school. We need to do this as a country, not because, you know, we can debate how and why and the best way to teach our kids. Let's get everyone to school first. Let's fucking take it from there.
Right. I was, somebody had posted something on Facebook the other day, a friend of mine, and I say friend very
loosely,
that children shouldn't be sent home with homework anymore because the home is family time. I don't mind the idea, of a 4-day school week. As long as you're being taught everything, as long as you get your work done.
I don't care. I don't care if it's a 2-day school. My point, though, is that closing, furloughing a day of school is not just being smarter about time. It's literally that they cannot afford to keep the school open full time.
And a lot of the problems have stem from tax cuts, because that's public funding from the government or from the state budget that they don't have. They just don't have. I mean,
right.
What are you spending your money on?
Well, they offer these tax cuts, you know, these states, a big problem. And this is where we're going to circle back to. These are red states. These are states that went for Trump, is that they offer these tax cuts and these tax incentives at the Trump and Paul Ryan style, which is, They offer huge incentives for the wealthy and for these large corporations. And these states have lost, you know, $400+ million of revenue a year since creating those tax cuts 10, 15 years ago. And so it's really politically fun and easy to cut taxes. Everyone wants more money. But then when you have to find money to fund your schools, all of a sudden everybody's like, well, there's no money in the budget. I don't know. We're going to there's such a fucking, like, disconnect between what people are doing and what people are saying. And so I think that with these walkouts and these strikes, what I really find interesting is that, you know, one of the parents from the Arizona school district who is who are doing the strikes right now, she actually is saying that she typically votes Republican, but would be willing to switch party lines in order to support candidates who want to increase education funding.
And Democrats don't talk enough about education funding. We talk a lot about pre-K, universal pre-K, right, and those things.
Well, again, sexier topic. Right. I know that sounds weird.
But past pre-K... I mean, yes, talk about pre-K, because early childhood development is super important.
Hey,
but
yeah,
you got to get those kids at elementary schools and middle schools and high schools just as equally need to be educated. And you got to talk to parents about that. I think Democrats have to, again, change the narrative to say your children matter to us and their education matters to us. And here's what we plan on doing. Right. People understand if you make it personal. Look, we understand that you feel that sending your child to a certain college might give them a quote unquote liberal education. But that is not the point of what we're trying to accomplish here. We're trying to make sure that your child is educated enough to where they can get that next job. Because jobs is what everybody wants to talk about.
Right.
You want that job. If you're a parent out there, if you come from a family who's, you're a first generation college student, to a parent out there, that sounds pretty damn good.
Right.
To hear that my child, that you want my child to be one of the first people in, the, in my in our family to go to college.
Right.
We're not only going to help fund your child's education from elementary school and pre-K and through high school, but we're also trying to figure out how best to help you who in Oklahoma,
right,
who do not make a lot of money, to help fund their education past that.
Right. You know, it's really frustrating. And I like to connect these stories back to, you know, with this feminist podcast. We obviously report the news in a very specific way. But big thing is, so much of education policy is often handled by women and mothers and parents, because that's, you know, who it directly affects. But this should terrify Republicans. Republicans should be running around with their hair on fire, because this is one of those issues that people have no party loyalty over. When it comes to your kids, you get out of fucks real fast.
I think the problem, the other, when I mentioned liberal education outside in college, the fear I feel that this is where that full circle of Republican to Bernie comes in.
Right.
Is the term elitist. Because people feel that educated people are elitist.
Right.
Because they just know things.
Right.
And I think that becomes a terrifying thing for people, because nobody wants to be called an elitist. You go home, you come from college, you go home, and you're now talking to your friends, and you're talking about things on the news. You're talking about, you know, SpaceX and Tesla and things that they have no idea what you're talking about. Then you are called an elitist at that point. And right, nobody wants their kid to be ostracized because of that. And so I feel like Republicans do everything that they can do, Republicans on the lower, not Republican politicians, Republican families, to keep their kid from becoming an elitist.
Right.
And that's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate.
Elitism is not a bad thing.
Right, right. Tying education to elitism is... doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make sense at all. I mean, it's like, you know, when they talked about Hillary Clinton being an elitist because she spoke a little bit more eloquently than Bernie Sanders, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you people?
Like, are you fucking kidding me?
You know, same thing with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
I'm 100% positive that Bernie Sanders, considering his interview last week, considered Barack Obama to be an elitist.
Yeah, right.
And Barack Obama was, again, from what I said in the first block, an Olivia Pope black man in America who had to be twice as good as all 43 other presidents.
Right. Right.
That's the reality.
Yeah.
It wasn't elitism.
Right.
It's just that if he fucked up.
That was it. Yep. You get
that's
one
why,
shot.
That's why Barack Obama had zero scandals.
Right.
His entire presidency, because the one scandal that Barack Obama had, and you can argue that Fast and Furious was a scandal. You could argue that the drone strikes were scandal. We're a dark spot
that's
on the
more,
on
that's
on the
more
presidency.
Controversial opinion.
Controversial opinion, right? Other than outside of that,
right?
Had Barack Obama had one person, look at what they're trying. Look what they're trying to do to Loretta Lynch,
right?
Is they tried so hard to tie one person,
right,
to be a problem for this. Donald Trump spent so much time trying to pin these DOJ people to Barack Obama as if he appointed them.
Right.
No, bitch, you did. No. Rod Rosenstein is yours. Jeff Sessions is yours.
This is your fucking
you
mess.
You reappointed James Comey because you said, come here, James Comey, in the room full of people. We saw the video. You gave him a hug.
Yeah.
And now you call him a slime ball because he didn't want to protect you.
Right, right. Well, and it's such a perfect point. It's such a perfect tie-in here, is because it's elitism when it's helpful. But you're right. It's more about the fact that you have to be perfect. You get one shot.
And that goes for for the next female president as well. We'll have to be perfect. Well,
right. There'll be no way around it.
Or any CEOs. Like, right. Right. Like, you know, Cecilia Richards, whatever. But I look at who ran HP? Carly Fiorina. Now look. She might be an exception to the twice as good. Yeah. Because, like, she fucked up.
A lot. But, and, you know, people love talking about that. People love talking about how much she fucked up. And, like, people love talking about how much Donald Trump fucked up, too. But he's fucking president, so.
Yeah.
So I really want to quickly mention two stories. We're not going to go into them. But one, Donald Trump pardoned Scooter Libby, which is weird. So we will actually have a Patreon episode about that coming up, because it is very weird and very random, so look out for that. And then the other one is Paul Ryan is not seeking re-election, which all I have to say to that is boy bye. And, you know, all the reasons politicians always give, I'm gonna spend more time with family, blah 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 blah, but I think it's because he sees the writing on the fucking wall.
I think that Paul Ryan knows, I think he has a challenger from the right.
Yeah.
I think that both Democrats in the primary on the left are very strong. I know somebody mentioned Iron Stash on Iron Twitter Stash. The other day, and somebody was like, but what about Mary? And I was like, I honestly could not even remember her name.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem for her.
Right.
Is that everybody knows Iron Stash, but nobody knows her yet. And right. I think that he's already got the machine. He's got the money.
Right.
And it's going to be a little uphill climb for her to win that primary against him.
I think as soon as Donald Trump won the 2016 election, Paul Ryan knew that he was retiring.
Paul Ryan only went to Congress for one thing: keg stands on Medicaid.
That's it. Stands on Medicaid. And that's it. Mission accomplished. We're going Jesus home. Get the Christ. Fuck out.
And tax cuts. But like that's really. And I'm not gonna miss. I think the scarier part is who will be the next potential speaker, because this is why it's important for Democrats to take back the House, because then Nancy Pelosi becomes the speaker.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed on that.
Right.
So I think that.
And you want to see shit get done? Put Nancy Pelosi back in charge.
Right. And I think Donald Trump, I feel like Donald Trump will do everything he can to butter up to Nancy Pelosi and try to get something done, just for the sake of ever saying that he reached across the aisle and he did that. He will. He's going to start sending her flowers or something. And I've said this before, I feel like Donald Trump just wants validation, like I said a couple of weeks ago, so much that he will say, you know what, Democrats, you just send that bill right onto my desk. I want the praise.
Right.
You give me all the glory. Yep.
And
Democrats won't do that. And then he'll be mad.
Right.
And then that will get him into 28. That will propel him into 2020 if he has not resigned or been impeached by the Democratic Congress at that point.
Yeah. All right, Drexel, let's jump into gratitude checks. So what are you grateful for today?
Well, last night, like thousands of Americans across the country, I stayed up to watch the Queen. The queen bee herself, Beyonce.
Oh, God.
At Coachella. Now, I understand that the owners of Coachella are everything that we are against.
They are.
I did not watch Coachella. Mm-hmm. I watched Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Beychella.
Beychella.
Outside of Coachella.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are two very separate things. It's like watching the Super Bowl when she performed. We were not watching the Super Bowl.
No, we were watching.
We were watching the
Beyonce show.
Beyonce concert that the Super Bowl just so happened to be a part of.
Right, exactly.
Coachella just so happened to be a part of Beyonce's concert last night. I say that because I was very grateful for the blackety blackness that Beyonce brought to bookend this episode. The blackety blackness that Beyonce brought to mayonnaise white Coachella last night. She put a little bit of Louisiana Red Dot hot sauce and smothered that shit all over Coachella and came out and gave us like straight up Cleopatra like realness.
Yeah.
From the beginning. Then She was like, you know what? I'm going to start out as Cleopatra, and then I'm going to move on to HBCUs. And if you don't know what those are, those are historically black universities, colleges and universities around the country, which Betsy DeVos tried to pretend her and Omarosa were like tag teaming on at the beginning. If you don't remember that, like that never happened. Okay, great. remember when Donald Trump brought a whole bunch of black people into the office? That was the first and last time he ever had that many black people around him. So Beyonce brought... she had this band. Now, if you've ever watched Drumline with Nick Cannon
which
actually came on TV the other day.
First of all, his character name is Devin. Second of all, I was in Drumline. Third of all, it's the best fucking movie that's ever been made.
It's so good. I always wanted to be the drum major.
Drum major. Mm-hmm.
But I was too afraid. I have a low tolerance for pain, and I was too afraid of like throwing the
thing. That you'll like smack yourself. I wasn't in the Drumline, but I was in the band.
Well, if you saw the performance, watch the fucking movie. You know that she had bleachers set up and an entire dance squad and a band up there. And then she created, as Beyonce does, her own sorority. I'm going to call it Black Alpha Kappa, because that's what or Beyonce Alpha Kappa or something. One of those two works. But it all tied back to HBCUs in a way that black people were like, damn, why should have gone to an HBCU? Then she got up there and said, towards the end of her whole spiel, reminded the million people, not only there at Coachella, but the thousands of people watching, that she was the first black woman to headline Coachella. She is not only the first black woman to headline Coachella, she was also the first black woman to bring a girl group to headline Coachella. She had the highest streaming download ever. And then she topped that off with, ain't that a bitch?
And you're just like, how are you this perfect?
Like, that's what she said. Yeah. She said, I'm the first black woman to headline. Ain't that a bitch? As if she knew who to target that to. Yeah. Listen, Coachella organizers, the next time I come around, or the next time black folks come around, you better have a few more of us, because I'm looking out into this very sea of white. And I'm bringing everybody a little black. And this is what they're going to get. And people were living for it. I'm surprised. I would have passed out. Right? I would just passed. I've seen Beyonce in concert before. I know that she is not some people's cup of tea, because some people think she's a little bit more commercialized than she should be. But again, Beyonce is commercialized. Why? Because she has to be twice as good, or she would have never headlined Coachella.
Right.
She would have never been the first black woman to headline Coachella, and she was. And the reason why her team is so particular and so focused and so commercialized is because had she not been that person, she would have never been on that stage last night.
Right. Right. Definitely. So, it's a double-edged sword.
Oh yeah.
Right. If you take it, you know, there's that balance.
Right. She'd take them billions to the bank though.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, yeah, okay, maybe she's too commercialized. She's also amazing. She's amazing to see in concert. And I absolutely would have passed out if I were there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm ready to join. I'm ready to pledge.
Right. That sorority.
Beyonce sorority.
100%.
I mean, it's a sorority, so I don't think I can get in. But
try. You can try.
We gonna do it. All right. What about you, Devin?
Okay. Mine is so not as good. Like, even a little bit. No, I'm just really excited. I've been talking a lot about going to the East Coast. I'm going to be in New York. My 6-year wedding anniversary is coming up.
Congratulations. Thank
you. And for my anniversary gift, I got an email this morning.
Oh my God, I saw.
From my husband, who had purchased me tickets to Harry Potter and the Cursed Child Parts 1 and 2 on Broadway for me to see while I'm in New
York.
When
are you going?
I'm going to see the show on Wednesday.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm just really excited. It was the most perfect gift someone's ever given me.
I loved his note.
Yeah.
It's
very
sweet.
Very sweet.
Very, very good use of the Severus theme. Snake.
Always.
Yes, love it.
So I'm very excited about that. It was very moving. And it's really great to know that I have people on my team who love me, support me, and get me.
Husband, you can stay.
Yeah, you can stay.
You don't have to sashay away just yet.
Yeah. Alex Handy.
You can stay.
You can stay.
All right, Devin, let's get into our favorite block and the final block of the day, our Dickwad of the Week.
Well, I mean, I feel like today we have a really obvious one, and it's James Comey.
Yes.
Okay, so I know you're very conflicted about this. So I'm just going to go ahead and say he is Dickwad of the Week because he is such a sanctimonious dick. Like, he has the tea, though.
He does have the tea. It's piping hot from Comeyland.
Yep.
He's been sipping on it for a year. Since he got fired.
And just kind of sitting with it. Just, you know.
Swirling around like he's the woman and get the mother and get out.
Right.
Donald Trump going to try to be getting out soon.
Right.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, I tweeted out early Sunday that I was a little conflicted on Jim Comey. Because I can understand the anger that us Clinton supporters feel towards James Comey, because even he said in his book that he felt that Hillary Clinton would win the election, and that I'm sure deep down he knows that part of what he did cost her part of it.
Right.
I'm conflicted in the sense that I am able to separate Jim Comey pre-election to Jim Comey post-election.
Absolutely.
And I think people should start to remember that what we saw James Comey do pre-election,
right,
has no bearing on what he did post-election, because he continued to do part of his job probably to get us to the point of Robert Mueller at that point.
I think, look, here's how I see it. I can simultaneously hate James Comey's guts and also support the way that he approached this Trump problem.
Right. And that's why I said I'm conflicted, because right. I want to.
I think he is a sanctimonious dick not just for what he did, just his whole demeanor and his whole like blasé approach to this very serious thing that we're
living. Some of his interview. I mean, I'm sure we'll watch the interview tonight with George Stephanopoulos. I mean, even in his congressional testimony, the way that he answered questions. Right. I was like,
I would not want to have dinner with that man. Let's put it that way. But you know what? I can hate his guts, think he's an awful motherfucker, and then also really enjoy the way that he compares Trump to a mob boss, and can understand what he did, why he did it, and why it was important.
Right. I say that because, again, as his book comes out, as more things come out from the interview this week, as we start to have those conversations with people about James Comey, I think that the approach, I think that we spend, and I'm sure some people are going to be like, Jackson, what the fuck's wrong with you? I think we spend so much time continuing to try to protect Hillary Clinton.
Mm.
That we have not yet moved past that point yet. That anybody who is a part of it,
right,
is a, like, we can't get past that
right
yet. And I think we've got far more important things coming up. An impeachment trial, I'm sure. A 2018 election's coming up. 2020 election's coming up. Joe Biden's out there saying he's probably going to run for president. Bernie Sanders.
Go the fuck away, Joe Biden.
In D.C. this weekend, I had some friends at the progressive something or other, you know, place where Keith Ellison, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cynthia Nixon were all that. So a troop of progressive candidates around there. So there's a lot of good things happening and a lot of problems happening. And some of those problems include Bernie Sanders. Some of those problems include, I'm sure to some people, Joe Biden, who shouldn't probably not be getting into the race. So the more that we continue to hunker down on Hillary Clinton, you know, I always said during the election, I said, there are two different, if you bring up, especially during the primary, if I had a conversation with a group of people, the minute that somebody brought up Bernie Sanders, that conversation was shut down. The minute that somebody brings up Hillary Clinton, because the other side, the conversation shut down. So I always try to remove those two
right
from conversations.
Right.
And the minute that you do, that's when those conversations can continue to open up.
Get good.
The minute that you remove James Comey from Hillary Clinton and really focus on, because Jim Comey's book is about his time with the last three presidents and up until through this president right here. today. So the more that you have those conversations about the legality of what he did and how he went about it, and really do it from a constructive way and not like you're trying to, like, you know, build the walls around Hillary Clinton, the better off you are as a debater, to somebody.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I think that, I think that when it comes to Rachel Maddow had a segment and I thought was very interesting about James Comey's book. And that is that this is an autobiography. Ostensibly, it's, you know, what he's done doing in his retirement. But also, especially the part about Trump is going, because Robert Mueller is going to be talking to James Comey and has already talked to him, and because this is an ongoing investigation, the shit in that book is true. Like, they, that is based on things that James Comey believes are true, because if they aren't, he's got a perjury problem.
I feel like James Comey probably should have waited to release this book after the Mueller, after the first set of findings came out.
But I'm so glad he didn't.
I say that because I feel like the Trump team will use that as a part of their defense.
But I think it's going to be good. But
anyway. Yeah, I'm not going to buy the book.
No, hell no.
I'll read the Cliff Notes.
Yeah. All right, Drexel, last but not least, we're going to do one quick action item for our listeners. So we talked a lot about the teacher strikes, unions, right to work laws. So, Hellions, here's what you need to do. Go out, find out, does your state have right to work laws? What does that mean? What do your teachers get paid? Who controls their salaries?
Are you a teacher?
what can we do to support you? And then education policy is shaped by state and local elections. We say it all the time. Local politics is sexy. Who's your governor? Who's your local rep? Who's on your school board? Find out. If you don't like them, run.
And she means run for office, not like run.
Oh, no. I mean, like, run towards them, smack them, and then take their seat. That's what I mean by run. Yes. So education policy is one of those things. It's very polarizing and it's very local.
And I don't even know why it's polarizing.
Right? Like,
you know what's polarizing?
What? James Comey?
James Comey. Diagramming sentences.
That's
That's polarizing.
Right. People get real heated.
I love diagramming sentences.
That's because you're an awful person. Nerd. Anyway, that is it for us for today. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back here later in the week with a guest, and Drex and I will be back here on Thursday.
And don't forget, tomorrow morning.
Good morning, Connecticut.
Good morning, Connecticut.